He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has quartered large bodies of armed troops among us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Today, we'll be discussing several grievances about the British Army in the colonies from the Declaration of Independence, but then we're going to feature some brand new historical research about homosexuality in the 18th century with my expert guest, John Gilbert McCurdy. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
John is professor of history at Eastern Michigan University. His research expertise is in the fields of colonial and revolutionary America, gender, and LGBTQ plus history. He is the author of three books, including Quarters, The Accommodation of the British Army and the Coming of the American Revolution, published by Cornell University Press in 2019. And most recently, he published Vicious and Immoral, Homosexuality, the American Revolution, and the Trials of Robert Newburg, published by Johns Hopkins in 2024. So, John, let's start with quartering and the problem that the colonies had with British troops on their soil. Here we saw the three grievances, which you touched upon from my list. That's grievance 11, 12, and 14, the last of which was he has quartered large bodies of armed troops among us. Can you just give me a brief overview of the process of quartering and why it pissed off the colonists so much?
Quartering is very important in the pre-modern world or in the early modern world. Soldiers are the most important weapon of war, which means they're people. You need to have a place for them to sleep, a place for them to take their meals. So anytime war happens, you need to have soldiers moving. For most of colonial American history, soldiers are not an issue because soldiers are colonial militiamen or provincial armies that are raised for only a short period of time. This changes with the Seven Years' War. In the Seven Years' War, Great Britain goes to war with France over control of North America and large other portions of the world. And to win this war, Great Britain sends tens of thousands of British soldiers, regular soldiers, to North America, and very quickly runs into problems with the colonists about, we want you to provide places for them to sleep, places for them to eat, and the colonists are not used to this. They are not used to having, in most parts of North America, this requirement. At the end of the Seven Years' War in 1763, the colonists hope all these soldiers are going to go away and these problems will disappear, but they do not. Great Britain decides to leave 15 regiments of troops in North America. That's about 7,500 men. Most of them go to Canada or out to the West or down in Florida, but a handful, about three regiments, will be stationed in the middle colonies in New York, Philadelphia, and New Jersey. And so it very quickly, the British government runs into conflict with the colonists over who's going to pay for these soldiers, and not their salaries, but their where they're going to live. So the Quartering Act is written by Parliament in 1765. The Quartering Act of 1765 says, if the soldiers are in your place, you're responsible for providing a place for them to sleep. The Quartering Act is interesting because it does not say soldiers will go into private houses. In fact, the Quartering Act is very clear. So soldiers will go to barracks, or they will go to public houses, taverns, or they will go to some uninhabited building that is to be paid for and rented out. Everything's to be paid for. So sometimes the Quartering Act of 1765 is assumed to be that the Americans hate it because it's putting soldiers into people's homes. The Quartering Act does not do that. In fact, it explicitly prohibits that. And the British Army is very good about being faithful to that part of the act. Nonetheless, the soldiers remain in America, again, about three regiments in the middle colonies. And over time, there's a concern about what should we do, or could the soldiers be doing more? For the first few years after the law is passed, the colonies are actually very complicit with the act. Many of the colonies will pay to build barracks, to provide food for soldiers, and other means. And the soldiers and the civilians mostly get along just fine. The problem comes in 1768 in Boston. Leaders of the British government decide that it would be a good idea to send 4 regiments to Boston to crack some heads. The soldiers show up, and they don't initially crack heads. They're there for about a year and a half, and actually 2 of the regiments are sent home because they think things are fine. But in March 5th, 1770, that of course the soldiers will fire onto a crowd of civilians, killing 5 Americans, and we know this is the Boston Massacre. So after the Boston Massacre, there's a great deal of anxiety over the soldiers, even in places like Philadelphia and New York, where they had been part of the community and had not been controversial. Suddenly they become controversial. This increases in 1774 when even more troops are sent into Boston, and the commander-in-chief of the British Army, Thomas Gage, is made governor of New York. Or rather, governor of Massachusetts. Get my colonies right here. They make Gage governor of Massachusetts. And this will ultimately lead to the Battle of Lexington and Concord the following year in April of 1775, which, as we know, begins the American Revolution. So I think all of these points in the Declaration of Independence refer to those. This incident, these conflicts over soldiers, the concept of standing armies without consent of our legislatures, the colonies are simply receiving these soldiers. They don't get any choice over whether British soldiers march into their territory or not.
Can I just be specific here? It says there, number 11, he has kept among us in times of peace standing armies. But here it's important, without the consent of our legislatures. Was there a precedent? Did various colonies in the past, did like the king or parliament say, we would like to do this? Do you agree? Was consent ever given?
Because yes.
Consent's such a huge word philosophically and politically throughout the Declaration of Independence and political philosophy at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why it's interesting, that word consent there. It almost implies like either it had been given by the right. colonial legislatures in the past, or it was just, you know, since the consent was never asked, it is ipso facto wrong that these armies are even stationed there at all.
Yeah, I would pull it apart a little differently. To your point, first, in times of peace, this is key. The colonists totally understand that at wartime, soldiers go wherever they want to because it's the exigencies of a military crisis. But, of course, they're not at war after the 7 Years' War ends, without consent of the legislature. So the way I read this is Thomas Gage, as commander-in-chief, is very clear. I will put soldiers in your territory, but they cannot enforce the law. They are simply there in case something military happens and I need to call on them. But soldiers cannot collect taxes. They cannot do police acts. They cannot do anything. Gage says, the only way I will let them do civilian actions is if the council, the governor's council in that colony, gives permission. Colonial government is a little strange, right? You have a governor, you have a council, and then you have the legislature or the assembly. The assembly is not involved in that discussion with Gage. So Gage is saying, well, I need more than just the governor to give me permission. I need his council to give me permission. And the colonists in number 11 are saying, no, we want the whole assembly of the legislature to vote on whether there should be soldiers in our territory or not.
So in your response there, you touched on 12 too. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. So
right.
In previous years, the expectation was, let's talk about soldiers. So maybe a soldier gets drunk and breaks some civilian's property or, mm-hmm. you know, does something bad off duty. That soldier would, well, presumably be tried by a military tribunal, but only after the civil tribunal acknowledged that this should go
right
to a military tribunal. How does that work there? Yeah. Number 12.
Yeah. Once again, Gage is very clear. If a soldier commits a crime, a civil infraction, then he will be held accountable by the local courts. And this happens certainly in Boston after the massacre. It's a civilian court that tries the soldiers. So some of this is a concern over that. There are incidences. There is an incident, I want to say it's in New Jersey, where a bunch of soldiers get drunk, they trash the town, and then before the sheriff and the colonists can come out to arrest these men, the commanding officer rounds the men up and gets them out of town because he knows they're going to be held accountable. And so there is a fear on the part of the colonists that, sure, the soldiers are held accountable as long as they're still here. But of course, the British military can whisk these soldiers away at any moment if it really wants to.
Okay, final question before we move on. Generally speaking, and I know this changes over the course of years as the revolutionary ferment grows and grows, It doesn't seem like the quartering of troops was hugely problematic for many decades then.
Right.
It became problematic, and having British redcoats around became more and more problematic slowly. Mm-hmm. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I think so. In the research I did for quarters, I discovered that the Stamp Act, for example, is immediately opposed by the colonists. The Townshend Duties, the Tea Act, all of these pieces that lead to the Revolution have almost an immediate response. The Quartering Act is not necessarily unpopular. It takes years for this to become an unpopular law and to become a cause of revolution. And I think even the way it's stated in number 14 is a bit vague. Quartering large bodies of armed troops among us. Well, okay, but that's pretty weak. So there are soldiers here. Okay, yeah. Is that it? But it says nothing of soldiers in private houses. It says nothing of soldiers are raping and pillaging. It's a very sort of weak charge, actually, against the king.
Yeah, he doesn't characterize the soldiers as they did the merciless Indian savages, which we discussed in a previous episode. And you could imagine that there was an opportunity here to describe British soldiers as bloodthirsty or unaccountable.
Yeah.
In some way. Good. Fascinating. Thank you for that exposition of those three grievances. And now let's move on to our second huge subject today, as we're going to talk about all the complexities of LGBTQ history in the colonies, and indeed of the discipline itself, perhaps, through your book, Vicious and Immoral. So why don't you just tell our audience how you came about writing the book? And I believe you said it came through your research, actually, into the quartering issue.
Sure. When I wrote Quarters, I went to the William L. Clements Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which has the papers of Thomas Gage, who I've just mentioned, the commander-in-chief of the British Army in North America from 1763 to 1775. And they're great. It's a great resource. The letters are very clear, letters both to and from Gage, and he collects all sorts of information because he's the commander-in-chief. It was toward the end of doing that research in 2011 that I came upon this trial transcript that I didn't know what to do with. And partly it had nothing to do with quartering, and it also had a bunch of names of people I didn't know. And so I set it aside. But it was curious because it had something to do with buggery. The trial was something about buggery. And so after I finished Quarters, I said, well, let me go back to this and see if I can do something with it. Maybe this would be an article. There's very little written about homosexuality or any of the queer topics in the era of the American Revolution. So I was curious, maybe this would be a good article since no one had written about this before. I discovered that the case was only one of many cases, I found additional trials at the National Archives at Kew, six trials, in fact, that connected to these people, and they're very explicit. They're very explicit documents in talking about queer issues and homosexuality, including what are people accused of doing, what does this look like, what are the consequences of somebody who may have same-sex desire. And so I thought, this is just too complicated to write into an article, and it's too interesting. The court-martial of Robert Newburgh takes place in August of 1774. It involves a lot of the same people who will end up in the Battle of Lexington and Concord. I thought this could be a great opportunity to put together issues of homosexuality and issues of the American Revolution, which I haven't really seen done before.
Yeah, and that's so interesting. And it's also interesting, of course, trials are great. I put that in scare quotations because they do provide us with historical evidence that we maybe can't get elsewhere. And it's interesting that you were able to find that. So you said that your research led you to think differently about the American Revolution. And why don't you just tell us how that thought process worked?
Sure. I think an easy question to ask is, are there LGBTQ plus people in the era of the American Revolution? Are they thought of at all by the people who are founding the United States? Are those issues at all of interest to men like Jefferson and Washington as they're creating the nation? And that was something I wanted to know about, too. And so that was what got me involved in this. And the book, A Vicious and Immoral, revolves around a one case in particular. And so I have to take a bit of an oblique approach to get to answering my question. Because what I'm looking at, just to give you a very quick book in a nutshell, is this revolves around a man named Robert Newburgh. Robert Newberg was a chaplain in the 18th Regiment of Foot, which was a regiment within the British Army. Newberg was from Ireland. He was a relatively young man. And he comes to America in 1773 to join the 18th Regiment, which at that point was stationed in Philadelphia. When he arrives, rumors have been circulating even before he arrives that Reverend Newberg had been sleeping with his servant, his male servant. And everyone in the unit is talking about this. And at first, the officers in the unit sort of ignore these stories. It happened before he joined the army. It happened, you know, an ocean away. Who cares? But over the period of a couple of months, Newberg's non-sexual actions begin to confirm suspicions that he has had sex with men. One captain sees him riding on a horse in very flamboyant attire. Newberg is also seen as being very fussy and litigious. He's not a team player. Finally, there is a fear that he might be interested in enlisted men. Is he trying to seduce enlisted men for sexual or other nefarious purposes? So the officers in the unit in the 18th Regiment refuse to work with Newberg. They tell their men not to go to him for spiritual guidance. Newberg makes a stink about this. He goes to his commanding officer. The commanding officer says, why don't you just go back to Ireland and deal with the issue there? Which Newberg knows if he does that, he will lose his commission and will be forever branded as a buggerer. So he insists on fighting for his reputation. He files a series of civil suits. And ultimately, there's convened a general court-martial in August of 1774 to get down to it. What did he do? And should he be removed from the army? Should he be cashiered and lose his commission as an officer?
So many points to explore in what you just said. And the first thing that I'm thinking about is, so did he deny it? Was he denying this?
So that's a great question. So he never explicitly denies it. And he never says, I did not have sex with my servant. He comes up with a series of other answers. He says, well, my servant is actually, I grew up with him. He's a foster brother. We've slept in the same bed for years because I'm sickly. I'm often ill. It's not uncommon for two men to share a bed in the 18th century, but these sort of explanations don't allay anybody's fears. And I think I'm never sure if he is, I don't know. At the end of the day, I don't know if Robert Newberg actually had sex with a man or not. That is never clear to me. Is he a wrongly accused straight man or is he a harassed gay man? I don't know. I write about him as if he were queer, because I want to use the book to imagine what would life have been like for a person who was a person who had those desires in this era. But I'm clear that I don't know.
Just some other potential theories I have. And again, it doesn't, I guess we'll never know, and that's kind of not the issue here. But some other things you said that would be explanations for the bad treatment he was getting was that he's Irish, right?
It could be, except one, he's Protestant Irish, and as are about half the people in this regiment. Okay. It says the 18th Regiment is also known as the Royal Irish Regiment. So the Irishness, I think, is not a condemning fact.
Interesting. But come on, riding on a horse in a flamboyant way. I mean, surely every officer in the British cavalry was riding their horses flamboyantly. But who knows?
Well, I think that's a key point. And so I think some of the suspicions about Newberg is that he's a chaplain, right? He's a religious figure. He's an ordained clergyman in the Church of Ireland, which is the Irish branch of the Anglican Church. And so he's expected to be maybe not dour, but certainly dressed in drab clothes, maybe not a cassock. And he apparently likes clothes a lot. One of the incidents will revolve around, he asks the tailors in the regiment to make him a new suit of clothes. He apparently brings several trunks of clothes with him. Even before he joins the army, there's a comment. Someone compares him to being a grenadier, which seems to be a comment about his flashy clothes. So, you know, on one hand, it's not unusual for civilians in the 1770s to be wearing stockings and lace and wigs, but it's unusual for a clergyman, especially a chaplain in the army, to have such clothes.
Okay, let's maybe take now a sort of meta-historical point on, obviously, there are lots of subjects in history that are very difficult to study through direct evidence because the evidence has been wiped away. The people I'm talking about LGBTQ issues specifically. Now, it's hard to access history in that way, because if you're not allowed to write about it or talk about it, then of course this history is difficult to unearth. So what are the challenges for you of studying LGBTQ plus issues, not just in the revolutionary era, but in general?
Sure. So the most basic issue is the terminology is different, right? So we use the term LGBTQ plus or queer, even the word homosexual. These are not 18th century terms. They don't show up anywhere in the text. So it's hard to do a word search, right, and find these terms. And the argument has been made that the terminology has changed, and that the changes in terminology actually reflect a change in thought. That buggery or sodomy are not simply old-fashioned ways of saying homosexuality. And this is the theories of Michel Foucault, right, the theorist and great historian of sexuality, who says, well, before the 19th century, homosexuality is not understood as an identity. No one is defining anybody based upon their sexual desires. That's a relatively modern concept. In the 18th century and points before, sure, men might commit this crime or commit this sin of having sex with another man, but it's a crime. It's a sin. It's something that should be corrected, and this person then should be forgiven and reintegrated into society. There's no understanding that this person is going to want to have sex with other men because that's innately who that person is. So that's also difficult. So and that's something that I was really curious about with looking at Newberg. Are the people who are accusing him of being a buggerer, and that's the term they use, do they think this is a crime he committed back in Ireland that they don't like? Or is there an understanding that there's something different about him? It's not just what he did, but who he is. That's getting much closer to that 19th, 20th century concept of what we would call sexual identity. And from my reading of the evidence, I think in the 18th century, at least in the case of Robert Newberg, there's a lot more evidence that the people are seeing him as being unique and different, not just about his sex, but the other things he's doing, the clothes he's wearing, the ways he's acting. They are starting to see him as different.
But specifically also, it sounds like effeminate is the problem that they have as soldiers.
I think so.
Or is that also a modern gloss that I'm putting on it?
No, there is a sense of effeminacy. Effeminacy would be, yeah, it's complicated, because on the one hand, I think effeminacy, certainly in terms of appearance, but in terms of sexual practices, there's not an understanding that he's passive in sex. Even when there's accusations he's having sex with his servant, there's an expectation that he's the active partner in sex. There's nothing unmasculine about the sex he's having, actually.
Just want to go a little bit deeper and maybe just explain to the audience, then, since it's difficult to access primary history in this period about the LGBTQ community, I think we also have this problem with Native American history. In that, since it wasn't written down, you know, we tend to think, well, and to what extent is that real history, like, you know, ours? I just don't understand maybe how we can sort of get through that. How would you explain that problem to a layperson?
It's a problem, an evidentiary problem, and this has been a critique of scholars for years, that especially when we're dealing with sexuality, our best sources are these cases. Legal cases, some courts martial, but other mostly just civil cases, criminal cases, in which you're seeing only one side. You're only getting people who are accusing, and you're only seeing supposedly same-sex people as defendants. And sometimes you end up in the situation where, like the famous Oscar Wilde trial, right, where Wilde is suing to claim that he's not a homosexual, which is obviously not the case. So there's something strange about the evidence. And we don't have, I'll go back to Robert Newberg. I don't have Robert Newberg giving me a diary in which he writes down all his deep fears and inner thoughts and dreams and fantasies, right? So, and even if I were to find somebody who I could definitely say, this person did commit sodomy, did have sex with a person of the same sex, even then we don't have where they're talking about their inner desires. And I think the comparison to Native American history is correct. Many times when we write Native American history, we're using actually European sources who are looking at these people from the outside, who don't understand them, who are making assumptions that may or may not be true. I think a lot of that is probably true of the 18th century, and when we look at LGBTQ plus populations as well.
Interesting. And maybe one other point I was thinking about, the accusation of disordered sex is one that we see back then, and yet it's not the only type of disordered sex. And I was just thinking of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson and what we now believe is the very common process where owners of enslaved people would have or rape or have sex or relationships, some sort of relationship with their slaves. And everyone knew it back then. Right. So I'm just kind of wondering to the sort of the accusation of disordered sexuality, how your understanding of buggery connects with, say, a relationship that Jefferson had with Sally Hemings.
When I was working on the Newberg case, one of the things that surprised me was, so he's accused of having sex with a servant. Who cares? People have sex with their servants all the time in this era, right? And just like the enslaved. These people don't really have a right to say no. There is no concept of you can't rape a person who's enslaved, right, legally in this era. And so it was interesting. And I think sort of how I explained that with Newberg, like, why are they worried about him having sex with a servant? Probably people are having same-sex sex with servants, I don't want to say all the time, but with more frequency than we have evidence of. It only becomes an issue if somebody makes a stink of it. Again, I think with Newberg, had the story circulated around, everybody laughed about it, and he said, no, it's not true, and just done his job, probably nobody would have made much of an issue of it. But he's acting in a way that confirms suspicions, and two, he's so litigious about it. He refuses to say, I'm sorry. He refuses to go home. He becomes a problem. And so this elevates this, what might have been a personal peccadillo, to a major incident that brings the relations of this regiment to a halt for a period of time.
Maybe let's move on now to discuss the general state of homosexuality in colonial times, as you understand it from your research in Vicious and Immoral. And maybe you can start by explaining if there was a difference in how homosexuality was viewed, say, in old Europe versus the colonies. Maybe I'm just being a sort of romantic historically. I might imagine if I were, you know, an 18th century punk rocker or gay person, I might want to, or hippie or, you know, whatever.
Right.
You might think of going to the colonies as a place where you could be more yourself. Would it be fair to say that colonial America was more liberal in a certain respect than stuffy old Europe, or is that just a modern stereotype?
there may be a hint of truth in that. So the official stance in the 18th century in both Britain and the American colonies was that homosexuality was illegal and immoral, and you didn't have to look far to find it. It's outlined in the Torah, both in Leviticus and the story in Genesis 19. Sodomy is a problem. It should not continue. It should not be allowed to happen. So sodomy has been a capital crime in England going back to the early Middle Ages. All 13 colonies made sodomy a capital crime. You could be put to death for it. Some colonies, at least one colony, Pennsylvania, tried to push back against this, but was informed by the British government, no, all of your laws have to be in compliance with British laws. So it's officially illegal and immoral. It's a capital crime, but historians who've looked at sodomy in the colonies say, well, it's really interesting. Very few people are ever put to death for sodomy. So why is this? And one answer I alluded to earlier is the Foucauldian explanation. This isn't seen as a pattern. It's just an act. Sodomy is something people did. It's incorrect. They should be corrected. They should be lightly punished. Most of the people who would engage in sodomy are going to be young men. Well, maybe they're just, they haven't gotten married yet. They don't know better. You know, they're playing around. We should whip them. We should find them. And then we should set them right. you know, they should not be executed. That's destroying somebody's life who could be forgiven and who could move on. A second answer, of course, is why we see so few prosecutions of sodomy in colonial America, is it's hard to prove a capital crime. You have to have two witnesses to prove a capital crime, and most sex then as now takes place in private. So oftentimes you don't have two witnesses to see two men or two women engaged in sex. A third answer is executions for sodomy are very impractical in colonial America. You need labor. Early America is land rich and labor poor. So they need as many young men in particular and young women as possible to work. And so we see instances where there probably was sodomy going on that everybody was looking the other way. A key example of this would be the 17th century Chesapeake, Virginia, and Maryland. You're importing large numbers of indentured servants, young people from England, overwhelmingly male. When these men get to the end of their servitude, if they're still alive, there's no woman for them to marry. There are just so many more men than there are women. Well, what do these men do? Well, some, we know, take up house together. Men will pool their resources, have a house, have a farm. And, you know, could just be two friends, certainly. It could be a marriage of convenience, as it were. But we know at least some will leave, when one dies, will leave his estate to the other man. One man, Walter Gifford, leaves a record to his loving mate. So there's certainly affection there, whether there's sexual action or not. And we know the courts of Virginia are not interested in prosecuting sodomy in this era. Same thing with masters. So if a master is accused, or a large planter is accused of sodomy, do you want to kill that person? That's going to be a huge disruptive force. All those people who are depending upon that person are going to have to be reassigned. And this is a case that comes up that's been written about a man named Nicholas Senshin, who lived in Connecticut. And he was repeatedly accused of propositioning his male servants, certainly has sex with some of them. The courts are very reluctant to act. He's taken to court many times. This takes place over 20, 30 years of his life. And the court is so reluctant to act. They just don't want to do it. They eventually fine him, but they can't jail him. They can't execute him because it would leave a power vacuum. A fourth answer, finally, to why we see so few executions would be, well, maybe Foucault was wrong. The historian Richard Godbeer claims, who's written about Nicholas Senshin, the man in Connecticut, says, well, probably the people in his town kind of knew this is how he was, that he kind of liked young men. I mean, he kept doing it over a period of years. It wasn't a one-off thing. So there probably is some rudimentary notion of sexual identity or at least desire going on here. And as I had mentioned earlier, it's really only when cases of homosexuality become disruptive that the courts come in and act. And so to give you one final example, there's the story of William Plain. John Winthrop writes about this in his journal. William Plain shows up to the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Actually, I think he's in New Haven. He shows up to New England in the 17th century. And reports follow him that he's had sex with men back in England. Once he gets to America, the story goes he's teaching young men how to masturbate. Apparently, they have to be taught how to do that in the 17th century. And so the courts will go to, the men of the town, the leading men of the town, go to Plain, and they say, you've got to stop what you're doing. It's immoral. It's illegal. Don't you know what you're doing is against the will of God? And William Plain says, what if there's no God? Which is not something you say to Puritans, right? So for that, William Plain will be arrested and executed. So it's one of these things, and I think there's going back to sort of Robert Newberg, there's a similarity there, that it's only when it becomes, there are mitigating circumstances, when homosexuality becomes socially disruptive, that people in America in the 17th or 18th century really want to get the courts involved.
This man who was executed, your argument is that he was executed probably more for his
blasphemy.
Yeah, blasphemy is the word I was looking for. Like you, and his inability, say, to apologize and play the part of a criminal who is sorry.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, interesting. Going back to how I started this, and my question was totally off base, but. Any different from Britain?
Sure, yeah. So the world I've described is very unique to the colonies, right? A dependence upon labor that's always fearful of being lost, a reliance of the state upon masters. a general lack of development. Great Britain in the 18th century is very different. You have urban London, it's a growing city. You have a sophisticated court system, a sophisticated state that is there to rigorously enforce the laws. There's less reliance on masters to enforce the law and less concern for a lost population. In fact, Britain is, of course, expelling people all over the world. They think they have too many people, so they're sending them to the colonies, you know, and eventually Australia. So there's that's one piece. Also in Great Britain, you have a really sophisticated print culture, which you don't really see in the colonies before the Revolution. And in this print culture, there's lots of prurient things being published, lots of stories of sex and intrigue. Homosexual scandals are very popular in the 18th century. There are multiple cases. One of the great ones, and this takes place right around the time of the Revolution, involves Captain Robert Jones, who's accused of having sex with a boy. He is taken to the Old Bailey, he is tried, he is convicted, and he is sentenced to die for his crime. Many people don't like that. So the case itself is covered heavily in the press and written about. And then when the sentence is given, that is also covered very heavily because a lot of people don't think that Robert Jones should be put to death, partly because he's been convicted only on one person's testimony, the boy he's accused of having had sex with. And so they start filing petitions to the king, demanding that King George III give a pardon to this man. King George III ultimately does. He says, you do not have to die for this crime. This was improperly decided. This evokes a whole new rash of publications condemning the king for standing up for sodomites. So there's a lot of public discussion going on and a lot of knowledge going on in England because of the print culture that you don't quite see in the colonies. You also have a sophisticated gay culture, if we can call it that, in 18th century London. As early as the 1720s, there are evidence of things called Molly houses, which, I mean, sort of seems like an 18th century gay bar. Men would dress up in elaborate attire, some dressing effeminately, some dressing as women. They would go to these to drink, to have sex. And we know about this because the Society for the Reformation of Manners finds out about these houses and goes to investigate and writes detailed reports about what they've seen going on. The people who are involved in the Molly houses are arrested. Some are executed. So we know there are places where men can go to meet other men interested in having sex with men that you don't really have in America.
So it would be wrong to characterize the colonies as being more welcoming. And I'm just thinking about this. And again, this is my modern historical perspective looking back, thinking of places like San Francisco or New York or the Midwest, Chicago, just places that draw people who feel like they're different, historically speaking.
I mean, you certainly have that, right? Many of the colonies are made up of people who, at least religiously, don't fit in, right? You have Catholics in Maryland and Quakers in Pennsylvania and on and on and on. I'm not sure I've ever seen an incident where there's someone who's running away because they're accused of homosexuality. But there's such a permeability of life in America. I mean, going back to the British Army, a number of men who joined the British Army come as soldiers. Why do you want to be a soldier and go to America? Well, because you can abandon your unit and go become a farmer. And they're probably not going to come after you. There is a freedom that's understood as coming with America in both its negative and positive connotations.
And going specifically back to Newburgh, did he not want to return to Ireland because he thought he would be equally discriminated against or harassed in some way there? Do we know that from the trial?
Yeah, that's harder to answer because he says initially he wanted to explore, he wanted to go to America, he wanted to see what the world was like, he wanted to get out of Dublin. But when he's accused of having had sex with a servant, it comes out that people have been gossiping about him for years in Ireland, at least for 3 years. This story has been passed around in Ireland. And so I think there's a fear of going home is going to be going back to face up to your accusers and being a subject to gossip. I mean, at the end of the, he will eventually retire. And from what I can deduce, lives out the rest of his life in Ireland and lives to the ripe old age of, I mean, he makes it into his 80s. So he has a long life.
Okay, so we've learned a lot about the differences between the understanding of homosexuality or buggery in the colonies versus Britain. And maybe we can just turn to another topic within our understanding of gender historically, which is simply the concept of manhood or masculinity in colonial times. I'm thinking about the episode we did on Jefferson, and of course there were certain characteristics that Jefferson admired about his father. He was an explorer and a builder and a creator of things, and we think of all these manly and masculine attributes. So how do you, as a historian and a historian of gender, think about manhood and masculinity in the colonial era?
Sure. I mean, I think basic to colonial and revolutionary era notions of manhood were a man was a person who had a family to provide for, which meant he then both had a family and had a source of income, either through land or through labor. And those were, they're not quite sine qua nons, because I do find instances of people who do not have families who can attain manhood. So this is always, my first book was actually on bachelors in colonial America. And one of the things I was interested in was to find that I found a number of high-standing men who weren't married. To go to the point of the Declaration of Independence, three men who signed the Declaration are not married when they signed the Declaration. Joseph Hughes from North Carolina, Caesar Rodney from Delaware, and Elbridge Gerry. Gerry will from Massachusetts. Gerry will later marry about a decade after the Declaration. So just being unmarried, just not having a family, wasn't necessarily a bar to political rights. Masculinity, I think, is also about sexuality. Men were supposed to be heterosexual, marital, and procreative in their sex, right? You should be having sex with your wife to make a child. That is the ideal sex. But there's certainly lots of sex that happens. There's lots of wiggle room around that. You know, there's a theory that in the early 18th century, a man could have sex with a woman or with a boy, and that there really wasn't a difference. As long as the man is the dominant partner in sex, the partner he's having sex with is less relevant. The sex of that person is. Sex outside of marriage is illegal and immoral, but even the Puritans can't stop it from happening. The Puritans in Massachusetts early on pass a law saying if a man and a woman have sex and they produce a child, God forbid, we're going to use the courts to try to get you to get married. We're going to take you to court and threaten you to get married. By the middle of the 17th century, even Massachusetts has abandoned this and says, well, it's not working. If you have a child out of wedlock, we're just going to make the father pay child support. I mean, the same answer we have today. And then finally, with masculinity, I think on one hand, we look back at the 18th century in the era of the American Revolution, and we say, well, these guys seem kind of effeminate to me, right? The ruffles, the wigs, the stockings. I think of the character of Isaac Higintoot in the sitcom Ghosts, right? He's supposed to be a revolutionary captain, and the whole joke is he's so effeminate. He's supposed to be a homosexual, actually. In that era, though, even those men who would have been wearing all these ruffles and wigs and lace, they don't see themselves as effeminate. They are more concerned about even more effeminate men. There is the idea of the macaroni, which is very popular in the early 1770s. This is a man who's incredibly effeminate and foppish. He's a dandy. He wears ridiculous wigs, really colorful clothes. He has no masculinity. Robert Newberg is accused of being a macaroni at one point in his trial.
That also sounds anti-Italian.
It is. This is an influence from the continent that's destroying good English morals.
Interesting. Going back to the sexuality thing and who one can have sex with, again, I'm thinking of Sally Hemings, and obviously everyone seemed to know that Jefferson had multiple children with Hemings, and I think historians would confirm that now, but it certainly didn't prevent him from becoming president and doing all that other stuff. So
right.
It's just interesting. All right, well, let's move into our last couple of points. Speaking of Jefferson, he wrote the famous lines, "All men are created equal." So what I'm thinking about now is, to what extent at all is he thinking about all men being created equal, including, say, gay men? In previous episodes, we've kind of understood that passage was meant to establish maybe the basic natural rights people have, but none of their civil rights. So I'm just wondering, to what extent is Jefferson, as he's writing all men are created equal, is thinking of people like buggers, I suppose,
right?
And to what extent I guess being a bugger is a natural right in one's pursuit of happiness, or is that some sort of civil issue that then can be legislated in the Constitution or afterwards? So basically, what's Jefferson thinking about buggery?
Sure. No, I think to sort of get at this, there's really two questions. So one is, do the people like Jefferson, when they're writing the Declaration of Independence, do they know that there are queer people around? And I think the answer is pretty clear they do. Whether they understand it as an identity or an act, they know that that's something there. So it's
or
not
a
like
macaroni.
Macaroni, exactly. They would not be surprised if you told them two men were having sex. They may not like it, but they wouldn't be surprised that it was around. But so then that raises the question of then, if they know these people exist in this era, are they thinking about them? Is Jefferson thinking about them when he's writing? And I think the short answer is no, but I think it's more complicated if we dig into it a little bit. First, and this is, I really took this from the book, that the colonists are not terribly interested in gay panic or moral panics in the 1760s and 1770s, partly because they're so focused on the tyranny of Parliament and the tyranny of the king. So in the 1760s, 1770s, again, the British are having a full meltdown, moral panic over, there are all these men having sex with men. What are we going to do about it? It's destroying the nation. Americans aren't repeating that in their newspapers. So I think that's sort of one point that, of course, Jefferson's not going to worry about this because, you know, he's more interested in the king. A second is the idea that if we understand the Declaration of Independence and its promises, it really flows from the ideas of the Enlightenment, which places a priority on the individual, and it's skeptical of religion, especially using religion to write laws and to police people's morals. The historian Charles Upchurch has made the argument that in the Enlightenment, we can see tacitly a place for LGBTQ plus populations, that prioritizing the individual and de-emphasizing the role of religion in the state all creates a place where you're going to be able to see gay rights eventually emerge. Whether it's not fully developed, certainly in the 18th century, but it's part and parcel of the Enlightenment that we know gives rise to the Declaration. Third, I would say Jefferson is probably not thinking about sodomy and buggers when he's writing the Declaration of Independence, but I think he full well understands that what the consequences might be and how this is going to affect the world. So when we look at the revolution, especially the Declaration of Independence, we say, okay, there's no provision made for women. There's no provision made for African Americans. But we also know that the ideas of the Declaration of Independence very quickly give rise to an anti-slavery movement, give rise to early pushes towards feminism. I think something similar happens with LGBTQ plus rights. And I say this for a couple of reasons. One, in 1779, so only 3 years after he writes the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson presents a revised legal code to Virginia and says we need to get rid of our old colonial laws and write a new set of laws that fits to our new nation. In this set of laws includes the recommendation that sodomy no longer be a capital crime. Instead, Jefferson thinks that a man should just be castrated for sodomy, but there is a push away. There is an understanding that this declaration has created a new world that's going to have more freedoms in it. Jefferson's ideas for a new law in Virginia don't get enacted, but the next year in 1780, Pennsylvania will write a new law for sodomy and remove capital punishment as a punishment for sodomy. And both of these ideas come from this idea that the government should be limited. That the government shouldn't be patrolling individuals in their personal lives. And so even though the Declaration of Independence isn't written prioritize the rights of buggerers and sodomites, I think inherently within the logic, you have to see there's a place for LGBTQ plus rights.
Okay, great. So now as we come to an end, I'd just like you to think about who you are as a gay American scholar, studying this period, the birth of our country, 250 years ago. What do you think as you are reading the Declaration of Independence, now as a person, not as a professional historian, 250 years later?
I remain very hopeful of the revolution, and I'm very hopeful of the promises of the Declaration of Independence, especially that idea that all people are created equal. At the time, this means no kings and no aristocracy, but I also know that many people since 1776 have read this document and understood it to mean there should not be slavery, women should have equal rights. even if that's not what's written in the document itself, that is inherent logic within it, which gives me a lot of hope. There's also a concept within the Declaration that the government should be limited. The government should not be in the business of policing morals, and it should not privilege certain groups over others, that there's a basic equality. Finally, to go back to vicious and immoral, at the end of his case, Robert Newberg, who serves as his own attorney in the case through his court-martial, gives a closing argument in which he gives an impassioned plea for equal rights. He claimed that it should not matter what he wore or what people said about him. So what if he dressed like a macaroni? So what if people were gossiping about him? He never claimed that he had the right to have sex with a man, nor did he ever admit that he did. But he said if he was good at his job, that the rest shouldn't matter. In many ways, he's arguing the personal is not political. For me, this is the real meaning of the revolution for LGBTQ plus people, that concerns about whether they're moral or immoral are not going to be any longer the concern of the government, that people are going to be free to live their lives in private without government oversight. And so I think inherently then within the revolution, there is a place for LGBTQ plus people.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.